A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to talk about something most people don't even know existed. Jerusalem once had its own airport, up at Adarot, and it wasn't some dirt strip with a windsock. It was a real airport with international flights, customs facilities, the whole thing. Now, the site sits at this strange intersection between Jerusalem municipality land and Ramallah under the Palestinian Authority, right near the Qalandia checkpoint. The city just announced a tender for 9,000 housing units there. So the question is, what was this airport when it actually operated? What happened to it? And given where it sits today, could it ever come back?
The timing on this is fascinating, because the Jerusalem municipality dropped that construction tender in April. They're calling it Adarot Hills. 9,000 units, 4 schools, a commercial center, and not a single provision for preserving the runway or the terminal building. So we're watching the final chapter of this airport's physical existence play out right now.
Which is probably why most people are only hearing about it for the first time, as it's about to get bulldozed. That feels very Jerusalem.
It really does. So let me set the timeline here, because it's genuinely surprising. Adarot Airport opened in 1920 under the British Mandate, originally as a Royal Air Force station. The RAF called it RAF Ramleh, though it wasn't actually at Ramleh. That name was a bit of colonial administrative confusion. After the 1948 war, it became Israel's airport for Jerusalem, operated by the Israel Airports Authority. Arkia flew from there. El Al had a presence, and by the 1960s, it was handling 200,000 passengers a year.
200,000? That's not a regional airstrip, that's a real operation.
It had customs, immigration, a proper terminal building with 1930s Art Deco architecture that's still partially visible under the graffiti today. The IATA code was JRS, the ICAO code was LLJR. If you pull up a 2025 Jeppesen manual, it's still listed, marked as closed indefinitely. It never got formally decommissioned.
That's the basic timeline. But to understand why the airport really died, we need to look at the ground beneath it.
Right, and this is where the geography gets wild. The airport sits at 31.8647 north, 35.2192 east. It's at 757 meters elevation. That's high for an airport. The runway, designated 12/30, is 1,968 meters long. And here's the thing about that number. A Boeing 737-800 at Jerusalem's elevation and typical summer temperatures requires a minimum of about 2,160 meters. So Adarot's runway is 200 meters too short for the workhorse aircraft of modern aviation. It was always a constrained site.
Which meant they had to use specific aircraft types. What were they actually flying out of there?
Mostly de Havilland Dash-7s. That was Arkia's workhorse on the Adarot routes. The Dash-7 was chosen specifically for its short field performance. It could get airborne in about 690 meters, which gave them margin even at that elevation. It also had a relatively quiet noise profile, which mattered because the approach path goes directly over populated areas. Arkia flew routes to Tel Aviv de Dov, to Eilat, and for a period to Haifa. El Al operated a weekly flight to Larnaca, Cyprus.
Wait, El Al flew a 707 out of Adarot?
In 1968, yes. One of the only wide-body operations ever from that runway. And that must have been something to see, because a 707 at max takeoff weight needs considerably more runway than Adarot has. They would have been operating at reduced weight, probably with fuel stops or payload restrictions. That Larnaca route didn't last long. It was more of a prestige thing, proving Jerusalem had an international connection.
The Jerusalem-Larnaca route feels like a metaphor for something. We're an international city, look. We have a flight to Cyprus once a week.
Cyprus is the classic first hop-out for this region. It's close enough to be practical, far enough to be international. But here's what really matters about Adarot's operational history. It functioned because the security environment allowed it to function. Between 1948 and 1967, the airport was on the Israeli side of the armistice line. The approach from the west was clear. The surrounding area, while not exactly tranquil, wasn't what it became later.
The Six-Day War changes everything.
After 1967, Israel captures the West Bank, including the areas around the airport, and at first, you'd think that makes things safer. Israel now controls all the surrounding territory. But what actually happens is Ben-Gurion Airport near Lod becomes the national hub. It's farther from any potential front line, it has room to expand, and the government makes a strategic decision to concentrate aviation resources there. Redundant is the wrong word. It becomes politically complicated in a new way.
Because now it's not on a border. It's inside something undefined.
The land around it is now part of what Israel considers unified Jerusalem, but the international community considers occupied territory. The airport keeps operating, but the investment dries up. No runway extensions, no new terminal, no modern navigation equipment. It's running on inertia from the 1960s into the 1990s.
Then the Oslo Accords happen.
This is where I want to correct a common misconception. A lot of people assume Oslo killed Adarat. It didn't. The airport continued operating for years after the accords were signed. The Oslo agreements placed the airport in Area C, which is under full Israeli security and administrative control. So legally, Israel could keep running it. And they did.
What actually stopped the flights?
The Second Intifada. In September 2000, the violence erupts, and suddenly the security calculus around Adarat collapses. The airport is within small arms range of Palestinian neighborhoods in Ramallah and Al-Biray. The approach pass passes directly over the Kalandia refugee camp. The Kalandia checkpoint, which is 800 meters from the runway threshold, becomes a major flashpoint. In 2019, it was processing 22,000 Palestinians per day. You cannot operate a civilian airport when your approach corridor is within rifle range of an active conflict zone.
The last commercial flight was when?
2000, an Arkia flight to Eilat, flight number 123, operated by a Dash 7. After that, the airport essentially became a military and border police installation. The terminal building is now used by the Israeli border police as a base. The control tower still stands, but the windows are boarded up and the radar dish was removed in 2005. The runway is still there. You can see it on satellite imagery, this long scar of asphalt with the markings faded but visible. But it's been officially closed to civilian traffic since 2001.
The airport had a good run, 50 years of actual operations, but by 2001 it was done. Now the question is, could it ever come back?
Let me walk through the three fatal constraints, because each one alone might be solvable with enough money, but together they make this essentially impossible. Ben-Gurion's Class C airspace extends to 5,000 feet over Adarat. Any flight from Adarat would need to coordinate with Ben-Gurion Approach Control, which is already operating at capacity. 80 movements per hour is their practical maximum, and they're bumping against that regularly. You'd be adding departures into an already saturated airspace, from an airport that's only 40 kilometers from Ben-Gurion as the crow flies.
40 kilometers isn't that far in aviation terms. London has Heathrow and Gatwick about the same distance apart, and they manage.
They do, but they're not sharing the same approach corridor. London's airports are arranged so that arrivals come in from different directions. Atarot and Ben-Gurion both have to accept approaches from the west because of terrain. The Judean hills to the east create turbulence and require steeper approach angles. So you've got two airports 40 kilometers apart, both trying to use the same slice of sky for arrivals. That's not a capacity problem you can solve with better radar.
That's before we even get to the security question.
Constraint number two, physical security on the ground. The airport lies within 2 kilometers of the Kalandia checkpoint. The approach to runway 12 passes over the separation barrier and the refugee camp. A feasibility study commissioned by the Jerusalem Development Authority in 2023 concluded that reopening Adarat would require $2.3 billion in security infrastructure alone. That's a new perimeter wall, underground baggage screening, a dedicated access road from Highway 443, and, this is the part that gets me, blast-resistant terminal construction.
$2.3 billion just for security. And that's before you've laid a single meter of new asphalt.
Even then, you haven't solved the fundamental problem. The closest parallel people reach for is Gibraltar Airport, where the runway literally crosses a major road and everything operates under strict military oversight. But Gibraltar doesn't have an active conflict within small arms range. No amount of perimeter wall eliminates the risk of a surface-to-air threat from elevated positions in the surrounding hills. The geography simply doesn't allow for a security buffer. You need at least 1 kilometer of controlled perimeter on all sides. At Adarat, you've got maybe 200 meters in some directions.
Even if you spend the $2.3 billion, you're buying mitigation, not security.
And constraint number 3 is the one nobody talks about. The airspace above Area C is claimed by the Palestinian Civil Aviation Authority. Under the Oslo framework, the Palestinians assert jurisdiction over that airspace. If you wanted to operate Adarat as a civilian airport with international flights, you would need a new airspace agreement with the Palestinian Authority. That is not on any current negotiating table. It's not even on the list of things that might someday be on a negotiating table.
You'd need a peace deal that includes aviation provisions, which is the kind of detail that shows up in the annexes. Nobody reads until the 3rd year of implementation.
If you even get that far. And here's the thing. The Jerusalem Municipality's 2026 construction plan for Adarat Hills makes it very clear which direction things are heading. 9,000 housing units. A commercial center. They're not preserving the runway. They're not preserving the terminal. This is a demolition and rebuild project. The aviation historians are furious. Some Haredi groups want the land preserved as open space, but the municipality has a housing crisis to address, and this is a large, publicly owned parcel.
The aviation historians versus the housing ministry is not a fight. The historians are going to win.
They rarely do. And I should mention, the terminal building is significant architecturally. It's one of the last surviving examples of British Mandate airport architecture in the Middle East. The 1930s Art Deco facade is still there, under layers of graffiti and military modifications. If you look at photographs from the 1940s, it has these clean geometric lines, whitewashed walls, a control tower with wraparound windows. It looks like something out of Casablanca.
Which is a movie reference that's going to land with about 12% of our listeners.
Worth it for those 12%. But the point stands, we're about to lose a physical artifact of Mandate-era aviation history, and almost nobody knows it's there.
Let me ask you something about the dual airport question. The prompt asks whether there's any justification for having an airport so close to Ben-Gurion, or if the two could coexist. You've laid out why coexistence is essentially impossible, but was there ever a case where having both made sense?
In the 1950s and 60s, absolutely. Ben-Gurion wasn't the mega-hub it is today. Sdedov in Tel Aviv was still handling domestic flights. Adarat served Jerusalem's population directly, and Jerusalem was smaller, the road to Tel Aviv was worse, and the concept of driving an hour to catch a flight felt like a real burden. Today, Highway 1 gets you from Jerusalem to Ben-Gurion in about 40 minutes if traffic cooperates. The train takes about 25 minutes from the New Jerusalem station. The connectivity argument for a Jerusalem airport has largely evaporated.
The justification disappeared before the airport did.
Yes, and that's actually the more interesting story. Adarat didn't close because of one thing. It closed because multiple trends converged. Ben-Gurion expanded and professionalized. The road and rail links improved. The security environment deteriorated. The aircraft got bigger and needed longer runways. The peace process created new political complications. No single factor killed it, but together they made it unsustainable.
That's a very Jerusalem story. Nothing here dies of one cause. Everything dies of 6 causes that all happen to arrive at the same time.
The site itself is now this strange palimpsest. You've got the British Mandate runway, the Jordanian-era modifications from when they controlled the area between 48 and 67, the Israeli terminal expansion, the military fortifications from the Intifada period, and now the construction stakes for a new neighborhood. 4 or 5 layers of history, each one built on top of the last, and the newest layer is about to erase all the previous ones.
What's the closest comparison? You mentioned Gibraltar, but that's still operational.
Nicosia Airport in Cyprus is probably the best parallel. It was the main airport for Cyprus until the Turkish invasion in 1974. Now it sits in the UN buffer zone, completely abandoned. The terminal building is frozen in 1974, departure boards still showing flights that never left, a Trident aircraft still parked on the apron. It's a ghost airport. Adarat isn't quite that dramatic, but it shares the same quality of being a piece of infrastructure that was functional until geopolitics made it impossible.
Tempelhof in Berlin is another one. Closed in 2008, now a public park. But Tempelhof closed because of a political decision about airport consolidation, not because people were shooting at the approach path.
Right, and that's the distinction that makes Adarat uniquely difficult. Tempelhof could reopen tomorrow if Berlin decided to. The runways are there, the terminal is maintained. Adarat cannot reopen without a fundamental transformation of the security environment across the entire northern Jerusalem area. That's not an infrastructure problem, it's a conflict resolution problem.
Let's talk about what the construction plan actually means, because this is where the story gets current. 9,000 units on that site. Is this just another Jerusalem neighborhood? Or is there something more loaded about building on an airport?
It's absolutely loaded, and I think the loading happens on multiple levels. First, there's the symbolic dimension. Building housing on the airport says, this chapter is closed. Jerusalem is not getting its airport back. We're moving on. That's a statement about the permanence of the current arrangement. Second, there's the planning dimension. 9,000 units is a significant addition to Jerusalem's housing stock, and the site is attractive. It's flat, it's already graded, it's publicly owned. From a purely technocratic planning perspective, it's an efficient use of land.
From a political perspective,
the site is claimed by both the Jerusalem Municipality, which considers it part of Unified Jerusalem, and the Palestinian Authority, which considers it part of the Ramallah Governorate. Any development there is a political statement about sovereignty. The Palestinian position is that construction in Area C, or in areas they consider part of a future Palestinian state, is a unilateral act that prejudges final status negotiations. The Israeli position is that this is within the Jerusalem municipal boundary, and therefore not subject to negotiation.
Building the housing is not just about creating housing, it's about asserting a claim.
That's true of almost every construction project in this part of Jerusalem. But Adarat is particularly visible because of what it's replacing. You're not building on an empty hilltop, you're building on a piece of shared infrastructure history. The airport served both populations. Palestinians flew from Adarat during the Jordanian period, Israelis flew from it after 48. It's one of the few pieces of infrastructure in the area that has a binational history.
And it's probably why the preservation argument has some traction. It's not just architectural nostalgia. The airport is evidence that functional coexistence existed, at least in one narrow domain.
Now that evidence is slated for demolition, I'm not sure the preservation argument will win. Housing pressures in Jerusalem are intense, but I understand why people are making it.
Given all those constraints, the answer to whether the airport could come back is pretty clear. But that doesn't mean the story is over. Here's what I think we should actually take away from this. Adarat is a case study in how geopolitical boundaries can render functional infrastructure obsolete. The airport didn't fail because of economics or technology. It didn't fail because passenger numbers dropped. It failed because the ground beneath it changed in ways that made normal operations impossible. That's a category of infrastructure failure that we don't have good language for. We talk about bridges collapsing and roads deteriorating, but we don't talk about airports becoming geopolitically unviable.
It's a category that's going to become more relevant, not less. As climate change reshapes coastlines, as conflict zones shift, as political boundaries get redrawn, we're going to see more infrastructure stranded by circumstances that have nothing to do with engineering. Adarat is a preview of that future.
The other thing worth noting is the airspace dimension, because it's the part that's hardest to visualize. When we say Ben-Gurion's airspace extends to 5,000 feet over Adarat, most people picture the reality is a complex three-dimensional puzzle of sectors and altitudes and approach procedures, and Adarat sits inside a piece of that puzzle that's already fully occupied.
That's the invisible wall we talked about in a previous episode. The one about aviation diplomacy in hostile skies. Adarat is a concrete example of how those invisible walls play out on the ground. The airspace doesn't care about your municipal boundaries or your historical claims. It cares about radar coverage, separation standards, and terrain clearance. Those are physical facts that no political agreement can wish away.
You'd need to redesign the entire approach architecture for Central Israel. That's not a negotiation. That's a multi-year airspace redesign project that would affect every flight into and out of Ben-Gurion.
The cost of that, combined with the $2.3 billion in security infrastructure, combined with the runway extension you'd need to accommodate modern aircraft, you're looking at probably $4 to $5 billion before you've sold a single ticket. For an airport that would serve, what, maybe 1 million passengers a year at most? The economics don't close.
The airport isn't coming back. But I want to push on one thing you said earlier, about Ben-Gurion approaching capacity. If Ben-Gurion hits 50 million passengers by 2035, which is the current projection, where does the overflow go?
That's the real question. The answer is probably not Adarat. The more likely options are expanding Ramon Airport near Eilat for international connections or developing a new site somewhere in the Negev. There's been talk for years about a second international airport in the south. Adarat is too constrained, too contested, and too small. It was the right airport for 1965. It's the wrong airport for 2035.
Which brings us back to the construction plan. If you accept that the airport is never coming back, then using the land for housing makes a certain kind of sense. The question is whether you preserve some part of it, the terminal building, a section of runway, something, as a historical marker.
I'd argue for preserving the terminal. It's small, it's architecturally significant, and it could be repurposed as a community center or a museum. The runway is harder to justify preserving. It's nearly 2 kilometers of asphalt that takes up a lot of developable land. But the terminal is a single building, and it tells a story that no other building in Jerusalem tells.
The story of a moment when Jerusalem thought it would be a city with an airport, connected to the world by direct flights rather than by a 40-minute drive to the coastal plain.
That vision wasn't crazy at the time. In the 1960s, Jerusalem's population was growing, tourism was increasing, and having your own airport was a marker of a serious city. No one in 1965 would have predicted that the airport would be abandoned within a generation. They were planning for expansion, not closure.
That's the thing about infrastructure. It encodes the ambitions of the moment that built it. And when those ambitions change, the infrastructure becomes a monument to a future that didn't happen.
Which is a good description of quite a few places in this part of the world. But I want to come back to something practical for listeners who are interested in this. If you want to see Adarat for yourself, you can. Pull up Google Maps, go to 31.8647 North, 35.2192 East. The runway outline is still clearly visible in satellite imagery. You can see the terminal building, the apron, the access roads. It's all there, just...
If the construction plan goes through, those satellite images are going to change. The runway will be dug up, the terminal will come down, and within a few years, it'll just be another Jerusalem neighborhood. The only trace will be in old aeronautical charts and the memories of people who flew from there.
Which is why I think this episode matters. We're documenting something that's about to disappear, not in a metaphorical sense, literally, physically, within the next few years. The Adarat Airport that operated for 50 years, that handled 200,000 passengers annually at its peak, that saw LL-707s and Archaea -7s and RAF biplanes, that physical place is about to become 9,000 apartments.
Once it's gone, the idea that Jerusalem ever had its own airport is going to sound like an urban legend. People will say, no, you're thinking of Ben-Gurion. Jerusalem never had an airport. And you'll have to pull up the old charts to prove them wrong.
The Jeppesen Manual for 2025 still lists it. JRS, LLJR, closed indefinitely. That indefinitely is doing a lot of work. It's been indefinite for 25 years now, and the construction tender is about to change it from indefinitely to permanently.
Here's the open question I want to leave on. The construction plan is moving forward. The airport is almost certainly not coming back. But could a future peace deal, whenever that happens, whatever it looks like, include a provision for a joint Israeli-Palestinian airport somewhere in this area? Not at Adarat specifically, but somewhere that serves both Jerusalem and Ramallah.
That's actually been floated in various Track 2 negotiations over the years. The idea would be a new airport, purpose-built, somewhere in the area between Jerusalem and Ramallah, jointly operated. It would require a completely different security architecture, new airspace agreements, and a political settlement that doesn't exist yet. But as Ben-Gurion approaches capacity, the pressure to find alternative sites is only going to grow. The question is whether that pressure produces creative solutions or just more conflict over the same pieces of land.
Atarot, whatever happens to it, is going to be the precedent that everyone points to, either as the airport that was lost to conflict, or as the site that was reimagined for something new. Which story gets told depends on what gets built on top of it.
That's the thing about building on top of history. You're always making an argument about what the history meant and whether it's worth preserving. The Jerusalem municipality has made its argument. The history is interesting, but 9,000 families need homes. The preservationists have made theirs. The history is irreplaceable, and once it's gone, it's gone. Neither argument is obviously wrong, and the tension between them is probably the most Jerusalem thing about this whole story.
I think that's the right place to land. Atarot Airport was a real, functioning piece of aviation infrastructure that served Jerusalem for half a century. It died not because it failed, but because the world around it changed in ways that made its continued operation impossible. And now we're watching the final act. The decision about what gets built on top of that history, and what story the new construction tells about the old airport.
If listeners want to explore this further, the satellite imagery is worth looking at. The coordinates again are 31.8647 north, 35.2192 east. You can trace the runway from end to end, see the terminal building, see the checkpoint just a few hundred meters away. It's one of those places where the geography tells the story more vividly than any description can.
For anyone interested in the broader history of Jerusalem's shifting boundaries, we've talked about this before in the context of the city line after 67. That episode covered the physical erasure of the old border, and Atarot is another piece of infrastructure that was reshaped by that same process.
The invisible walls of aviation diplomacy show up here too. The airspace constraints that make Atarot unviable are the same kind of constraints that shape flight paths across conflict zones worldwide. This is a local story with global echoes.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, a Harvard researcher studying bats in Guyana discovered that a single echolocating bat emits roughly 200 ultrasonic pulses per second while hunting, which, if scaled to human proportions, would be the auditory equivalent of shouting at 140 decibels 200 times per second, or about as loud as a jet engine firing in pulses faster than a hummingbird's wings.
Right.
A lot of shouting.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flemingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show. You can also visit myweirdprompts.com for transcripts and more. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.